Well, thanks for that. I mean, again, I hope that the message that people will take away is that, if anything, by working that guidance throughout the standard, that we think we've contributed to the ability of the auditor to scale the audit to the size and complexity of the company rather than taking something away.
Yeah, I would just like to add to that it remains very important to the staff, and we, as Sharon said, we believe this is actually going to be more effective by putting that guidance really in the places where it's going to make the most sense to the auditor as they read it. I think, though, also, this is a principles-based standard. It focuses the auditor on the principles of the audit and those objectives that need to be achieved in a way that AS2 didn't. And this, in and of itself, I think will contribute greatly to the auditor's ability to appropriately scale and tailor the audit to the specific facts and circumstances of each company that the auditor is auditing.
At the meeting in December, I took you through some recommendations that the SEC's Advisory Committee on Smaller Public Companies had made in terms of changes to AS2. Recommendation 3S1, for those keeping score in the Advisory Committee's report, suggested that we do a number of things to auditing standard number 2. And we did address most of those. I'm not going to repeat that again, but there are two of them that I think still attracted considerable amount of attention in the comments, and I'd like to just ask about those. And first, the Advisory Committee recommended that, the way they phrased it, the SEC asked the PCAOB to state that materiality for purposes of assessing internal control should be determined on an annual rather than a quarterly or an interim basis. We have not made that change, and I wonder if you could comment on what the reasoning behind sticking with annual and quarterly in the definition of material weaknesses.
Well, the definitions is definitely one of the places where we coordinate most with the SEC, and the definition of material weakness, clearly one of those areas. In fact, the SEC actually, as the definer of internal control and effective internal control, we actually looked to them and coordinated with the definition that they put together on material weaknesses.
And it wouldn't be feasible for us to have a different definition.
Right, wouldn't make sense. We want to make sure we're coordinated.
And our, I don't know if they released anything from their meeting yesterday, but our understanding is that from their meeting yesterday, their definition also looks at annual and quarterly.
Exactly.
The second thing I want to ask about is that the Advisory Committee recommended that the probability component of the definition of material weakness and significant deficiency change from more than remote to reasonably possible. And we have indeed done that. We've done it with respect to material weakness. We no longer have a probability-based definition of significant deficiency, so it's not directly relevant there. However, I noticed that within the past week, I think, the two co-chairs of the Advisory Committee have written to Senators Kerry and Snow, and I guess also to us in the SEC, and urge that reasonably possible instead become a reasonably likely or something similar. We haven't made, and that point was made in some of the comment letters during the regular comment process also. Of course, we haven't done that. I wonder if you could comment on why we haven't or what the implications of that kind of change would be.
Sure. We continue to think that reasonably possible or reasonable possibility, however you exactly phrase that, is a better choice than reasonably likely. That reasonable possibility will result in more consistent and more appropriate implementation in practice. But we have concerns about reasonably likely and how folks interpret that, particularly more casually. As you and I were talking the other day, there is some literature that talks specifically about it. The SEC's rules on MD&A make clear that reasonably likely does not mean more likely than not. It's a different threshold. I think casually a lot of people equate them, though. A lot of folks hear reasonably likely as being a high threshold, too high a threshold to result in appropriate application here, which is why we continue to prefer reasonably possible.
And if I could just go back to when we recommended and you adopted auditing standard number 2, we purposefully used the definitions that exist in the accounting literature and have been there for many years. So auditors and accountants have a lot of experience implementing the terminology that we borrowed from in creating that definition. So we feel that that is, from the auditor's perspective, a better way to define it.
Well, thanks for that. And I do agree with you. This is something I've tried to give some thought to. I mean, as Laura says, the phrase reasonably likely appears in the SEC's MD&A instructions. And I really have great reservations about whether injecting that concept into our standard would accomplish what the proponents are urging. And as Laura has said, the SEC has said that it's less than more likely than not. They also, in the MD&A world, have a sort of a presumption that if you can't affirmatively conclude that something is not reasonably likely to occur, then you must act as if it is reasonably likely to occur. That's always kind of made my head spin, and I'm afraid it might have the same effect on auditors. I think we're better off to stick with a concept that's more familiar to them. Let me ask about another point, again, that I think you touched on in your comments. The standard says that the auditor should use a top-down approach, and should is kind of a magic word in our lexicon because it implies an obligation or creates an obligation that must be fulfilled or the reasons why not documented. Then there's a note to paragraph 21 which says, the top-down approach describes the auditor's sequential thought process in identifying risks and controls to test, not necessarily the order in which the auditor will perform the auditing procedures. I wonder if you'd elaborate a little on what that means and what the documentation implications of that are. How do you document the sequence of your thought process?
Well, the purpose of that note, really, we believe that the top-down approach is more the auditor's perspective, how they go about planning and performing their audit, as opposed to we want the date sequence of every single step to be following that. And so when in the evaluation of shoulds, we believe that a should be there, that it's important to follow a top-down approach to get an effective audit. At the same time, we struggled over the having the should there because of the documentation requirement. Well, does that mean that what auditors are really going to be focusing time and energy on the dating and the order in which they have their work papers and those kinds of things? And so we felt it was necessary to make clear that this should be how you think about it. You should start with the financial statements. And you said that the top-down shouldn't be your roadmap, but I would say that the opposite, that the top-down should be the roadmap for at least their thoughts, how they would get. You start with the end in mind. You start with your financial statements, look at your entity-level controls, and maybe you're assessing your entity-level controls based on what you expect it to be, but you're not necessarily running out and testing all of those before you can even begin on the next steps in the process. It's more how you're thinking about it and how the perspective you're coming from in performing this audit and planning the audit. And we wanted to make that clear. Now, how do you then you run into the question of, now that you've said that, it doesn't have to be in this order, how do you document and demonstrate your thought process? And I think that we're expecting to see that the overall work papers will demonstrate that the auditor looked at these things and thought about these things in that way, but I don't expect that we would be trying to find evidence to link together, and certainly not on a sequential time date stamp or anything like that to see that they did it. We just want auditors to take this approach in their thought process.
So our inspection staff won't be looking to see that certain things happen on Tuesday and certain other things happen on Wednesday, and if the order is reversed, then there's a problem.
Yeah, when we were thinking about this, particularly in light of the fact that many companies now have been through this process 3 years, auditors know these companies very well, and the sequential order of when they test company-level controls versus other controls becomes a little bit less important. So we thought it was appropriate to allow for that flexibility while really providing, I think, a finer point on what we mean by top-down, in that it is, in fact, a perspective or thought process that helps the auditor understand how to identify those things that are really the controls that are really important and need to be tested.
Well, let me turn to something else that I guess has been controversial since AS2 first came out, and that's the list of strong indicators of material weaknesses and significant deficiencies. I mean, first the the strong indicator list with respect to significant deficiencies has disappeared from the standard, so we won't talk about that. But there is still a list of four things that are said to be indicators of material weaknesses. However, the words should and strong have disappeared. And it no longer says that the auditor should treat certain things as strong indicators, just lists certain things that are said to be indicators of material weaknesses. And I wonder if you could discuss what the reason for that change is and what you see the implications of it as being.
Well, I'll start on that, and then maybe Laura and Tom can jump in. But I think we, as we went through the comment letters, we found persuasive some people's suggestions that, in fact, having a long list of strong indicators, especially this one spanned, I think, three pages, it almost becomes a checklist that the auditor goes, I bring my deficiencies here, and if I get to the end of the list and I don't have one, then I'm done, and that, in fact, it might have been precluding auditor judgment or stopping the auditor from using their judgment to determine whether it's a material weakness, as opposed to what we were hoping, which is that it would actually help them in that evaluation process. So we reevaluated everything that was on there. We also had comments that a few of the items that were on there, really an ineffective risk assessment process would probably be more than an indicator, in the COSO framework at least, probably every framework, and that we should probably consider whether that's really an indicator. And so we determined that those should come off. And so in looking at it, and also in coordination with the SEC, who's using, we're both using the exact same list of indicators, we came up with four that we think are good things for the auditor to think about as they finished their evaluation process, as some indicators. These are not by any means an exclusive, all-encompassing list of them, but some indicators the auditor wants to give some thoughts to, but certainly not every indicator is on this list. It's just a few we want to make sure to point out. As the auditor's working through that process, but there are definitely a lot more that they'll need to be thinking about.
And that's very helpful. I guess as I travel about, the indicator that I hear the most about is restatements as an indicator of material weakness, and as people often have a sort of a generalized complaint that they feel they get what they regard as trapped into a material weakness when there's been some sort of change in interpretation of an accounting principle. They thought their financial statements were correct in the past based on what they believed was proper accounting interpretation, not a principle itself, but an interpretation, at least in their view, changes. There's a restatement, and then there's also material weakness as a result. And I just wonder if you could just comment about how that situation should be approached and whether there's been any change in the standard in that regard.
It's clearly a facts and circumstances situation. If a company restates its financial statements to correct a material misstatement of those financial statements, that remains, in our view, an indicator that there's a deficiency that the auditor should be looking for and that deficiency is, in fact, a material weakness. But again, it's got to be based on the facts and circumstances of the particular situation. So as we've emphasized in the past, if the indicator is tripped, it's not automatically a material weakness. In fact, it's not automatically a deficiency, but it is arguably a red flag that should cause both management and the auditor to evaluate whether there is a deficiency in their internal control.
What they need to be asking themselves is, what's the root cause that allowed us to find ourselves in this circumstance? We continue to think it's fair and important that folks confront that question. As Tom said, that the ultimate answer to that question may vary in the circumstances, whether there's anything at all wrong with internal control or, in fact, whether there's a material weakness.
Well, that's exactly the point I was hoping to bring out, and I hope that actually by deleting should and strong, we're forcing people to do harder thinking about what that root cause is, rather than simply look at a list and say, well, you know, this occurred, so we're going to say there's a material weakness. There are a lot more things that would be fun to ask about, but let me just close with one. I mean, Sharon, I think you touched on transition and effective date at the end of your comments. I wonder if you could just go through that again. I mean, as I understand it, we're looking at a situation here where there can be a period of time where there's a choice, where AS2 or AS5 might be in use. Isn't that going to create some confusion in the system, or how will that work?
Well, I don't know that it would cause confusion. I mean, there will be two different standards, you're right. The thing is, the auditing standard number 2 and auditing standard number 5 is built on auditing standard number 2, and there's a close enough connection, and requirements that were in AS5 were all in AS2. So if somebody has been embarking on AS number 2 and they're, you know, two-thirds of the way down, they should be able to make an easy transition to AS5. If for some reason, and we don't expect it to be very many, they decide not to early adopt and decide, you know, for whatever reason that they're far enough down there, then we wanted to leave that option open for whatever reason that might be. But we do expect that they will, most people will make the change when it's available to AS5. The reason for keeping the definition, we have already given guidance on the definition that we will have in AS5 and explained and encouraged people to begin thinking of this as reasonable possibility even under auditing standard number 2. So we wanted to make clear that upon approval of the standard by the SEC, that they should begin using that definition regardless of whether they are AS. For some reason, they stick with AS2, but the majority of people will go to AS5.
Okay, and I guess that would just serve as a corollary to that. I guess that you probably aren't in the business of making cost predictions, but you don't anticipate the kind of learning curve costs for auditors moving from AS2 to AS5 that I think we saw in the first year of moving from nothing to AS2.
I certainly don't expect that kind of a learning curve. Auditors now have 3 years of experience auditing internal control. I think they know a whole lot more about internal control than they have prior to that experience, and applying this more principles-based approach should not be a major learning curve for them.
Thank you very much.
Charlie Niemeyer.
Thank you, Chairman Olson. Let's face it, the principal motivation of the project to revise the standard on internal controls has been to address concerns about cost. So it shouldn't be a big surprise that sometimes what gets lost is that Sarbanes-Oxley's provisions on internal controls and auditing have been resoundingly beneficial to investors. Those benefits have been measured and documented and remain uncontroverted. Both companies and their investors have benefited from a reduced cost of capital. Researchers have measured this cost of capital reduction on the tune of about 150 basis points, where auditors have reported that companies have cleaned up their internal control problems. So I mean, that's true cost savings that investors can appreciate. The investing public has received important warnings that some companies' internal controls may not be able to detect or prevent a material misstatement. Probably the most spectacular example of that of late is Repco, with a disclosure in connection with its IPO, reporting two significant deficiencies of its internal control predated the later collapse of that company, where it was revealed that related party transactions were designed to help hide its losses. Instead of learning about the problems only after the fall, this time investors learned that there were risks ahead of time. And we're also seeing unprecedented numbers of companies identify and fix problems in their controls, as well as their actual reporting, in most cases before they can turn into disasters like Repco or other scandals, the names of companies which we know all too well. Since the first year of internal control reporting and auditing, the percentage of companies reporting material weaknesses has dropped precipitously, from a high point of 16.9% the first year to 10.5% the second year, and down the third year, as Chairman Olson previously said, in April of 2007, only 5.4% of third-year filers have reported having material weaknesses. This is a very important improvement in our system. Not only does it benefit the companies, the less risk to auditors, but certainly less risk to the market as well. These benefits outweigh the associated costs by any measure. Moreover, there's encouraging evidence that based on corporate proxy reports, the costs have turned out to be less than some had previously feared. And quite naturally, the costs have decreased since the first year of implementation. In evaluating the standard, I have focused on making certain that the core principles essential to an effective internal control audit were retained. I am satisfied that the revised standard does so. Ultimately, though, the success of a principles-based standard depends on how it will be implemented in practice. Maintaining the benefits described will require faithful application of the principles in the standard. This will also require consistent and balanced oversight of the firm's implementation and concern for more than just reducing cost. It's indisputable that internal control audits should avoid unnecessary cost, and I think the new standard helps auditors to do so. But what's most important to our capital markets is that investors have confidence in the accuracy and reliability of financial reporting. An effective audit does that, and in so doing contributes value far in excess of its cost. I would certainly like to think as well, there's so many people to actually, it's such an extraordinary effort and people involved know who they are, but first off, certainly Tom and Laura and Sharon, you have gone above and beyond. Your patience, your endurance is quite incredible, but as well as your intellect and ability to stay focused. Laura, we'll certainly miss you, and no matter what Tom says, I think you made a major contribution. I think we sometimes forget here that there may be a limited number of people in the world that are truly passionate about setting auditing standards, so we recognize that we're very fortunate to have all of you. I'd also like to thank, though, Sam Guzman and Dima Andriacco. I think certainly your contributions have been very important as well. GC, for keeping us on the straight, trying to anyway, Gordon Seymour and Jake Lesser, as well as John Amron, who provided always there for research and help with statistics. I'd also like to thank Chairman Olson and the board for the collegiate atmosphere that made this standard possible. Thank you.
Kayla Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, my colleagues, Mr. Ray, Ms. Phillips, and Ms. Verard. So much has been said about Section 404, internal control over financial reporting, AS2, now AS5, in the past 3 years, that I am tempted to pass my opportunity to speak and move simply to a vote. It's tempting, but you know me too well. Since the board first adopted auditing standard number 2 in March of 2004, much energy, ink, and angst has been spent debating how auditors should go about the internal control audit, how invasive it should be, how much it should cost. In my mind, this debate is often focused on the trees. Should the auditor provide one or two opinions? Should the auditor look at major classes of transaction and significant processes? Should the auditor and company manager assess the same controls in the same way, in the same frequency, which unfortunately sometimes lost sight of the forest? I support the auditing standard before us today. I support it because it requires auditors to perform a full and meaningful audit of a company's internal controls over financial reporting and to report the results of that work to the company's owners and prospective owners. The standard lays out clear objectives that auditors must meet and for which they will be held accountable. Most importantly, I believe that these objectives rationally relate to the purpose of an internal control audit, and that is to provide investors with the independent auditor's reasoned and reasonable judgment as to whether a company's controls are structured so that financial reporting is likely to be materially accurate. Secondarily, but certainly not incidentally, auditors should be able to meet the objectives of the standard in a way that does not require the expenditure of unnecessary resources. This, gentle listeners, is the forest. Might an auditing standard be written that creates a similar forest with a different set of trees than we have before us today? Most certainly. But in my humble opinion, AS5 represents this board's best collective balancing of the competing interests that have been voiced during what all who have participated in it must certainly agree has been a full and open opportunity for comment. With our action today, I look forward to joining with my colleagues on the board and the staff to move on to address other very critical issues in the areas of standard setting. Before I ask a few questions, I would also like to join others in thanking and acknowledging our talented and dedicated team of professionals. Tom, Laura, Sharon, what more could be said? We truly value not only your patience and your intellect,
the humor with which you have helped us all, guide us through this process. And of course, Sam and Dima, we've very much appreciated, Jake and Gordon. I also want to thank all the people in OCA and OGC who kept the trains running while we've all been very focused on this. And I, of course, like to also thank our colleagues and friends at the SCC, John White, Con Hewitt, Savannah Palmrose, Nancy Salisbury come to my mind. I've not, unfortunately, I'm not sure which, had the opportunity to sit in all of the meetings. So if I've left people off, I apologize. I also want to obviously thank the commissioners. They provided a great deal of access and openness to us on their thought processes. I'd also like, lastly, to thank all the commenters. Some people will notice that there was even a auditing graduate class that I think gave credit for students who commented. And we thank each and every comment because we all read them very thoroughly. I have a few comments and some questions. You mentioned the SEC input that was provided us with their open meeting, and particularly the direction to try to align our standards. I think you've given a good explanation, and I know that yesterday's open meetings of Anna Palmrose also gave a very good explanation as to why alignment is what we're seeking and not identity or an identical standard. And I want to point that out for the record. People will look at the auditing standard, too, and will see that it is not written in the same way as the SEC's management guidance. It uses, when there are similar terms, they have similar definitions, if not identical definitions. But the level of prescriptiveness, and I use that word cautiously because it seems to have taken on a very negative tone, but I don't think it is meant that. It should be interpreted that way. The level of prescriptiveness is different, and you've cautioned that out because the independent auditor is, in fact, independent of management and must perform different types of procedures simply because they are not there on a day-to-day basis. Management has a wider array of opportunities to test internal control as the independent auditor, and I won't go on further from that. One of the things, though, that has been changed, and coordinated is the word, is some of our definitions. Now, a material weakness, has that definition changed from what was proposed?
The definition of material weakness that we're proposing you adopt is essentially the same as that which was proposed. I think there are some minor wording changes, and unfortunately I just don't have that at my fingertips.
I wanted to get to the record that is essentially the same. The definition of reasonable significant deficiency, and just to clarify for those listeners, a material weakness is something that must be reported to owners and prospective owners. A significant deficiency is something under the law that management is required to report to the audit committee, and under this standard, the auditor is similarly obligated to report to the audit committee as well. How has that definition changed, if at all?
The definition we proposed in December, similar to the definition that existed in auditing standard number 2, it explicitly laid out a likelihood and magnitude test. The magnitude test we changed in the proposal to focus on misstatements that are less than material but yet important enough to merit attention of those that have responsibility to oversee the financial reporting process. In looking at the comment letters and in reevaluating that proposed definition, I believe that the operative aspect of that definition really related to that magnitude aspect, the focus on those things that are important enough to merit attention of the audit committee, essentially. So we have therefore proposed and in working with the Securities and Exchange Commission to change that definition to essentially get to that point immediately. So the definition essentially now reads that significant deficiencies are those that are less than material weaknesses, yet important enough to merit the attention of the audit committee or those responsible for oversight of the financial reporting process.
Thank you. I strongly support that definition. I note that the SEC authorized a proposal to be released from that organization to formally adopt that, but it must go through a rulemaking phase. I think that the definition provides shareholders with assurance that those to whom they have delegated responsibility for management of the company, that is the board, and in this context acting through its audit committee, will have access to the information they need. to appropriately monitor the quality of a company's internal controls. It talked about the former, what people had called AS6, our separate proposal or separate standard that would have talked about using the work of others, and how we have sort of gone away from that and incorporated the concepts of using the work of others within AS5 itself. And in my mind, I must admit that our proposal was a little complicated and a little convoluted in my mind to work through. I think some commenters had similar impression. So I'll just try to go to the bottom line. Will more or less work conceptually be permitted to be an auditor to rely upon others under the proposal versus what we have before us today?
Conceptually, I guess there's a small slice of the work of others that we've taken back on. The proposal would have allowed the auditor to use the work of others broadly, you know, not just internal audit, but others that are sufficiently competent and objective for all the work that's done in the audit of internal control and the audit of the financial statements. The end result of the package that you have before you today is that an auditor can use the work of others in testing internal control. They still would need to look more narrowly to internal audit, or folks that look a whole lot like internal audit, to use that work as substantive procedures in the audit of the financial statements.
So in other words, it's the non-internal control work that has been narrowed from the proposal, and the proposal broadened it from the existing literature. Is that correct?
Correct. And now we're going back to the existing literature in that regard.
We've talked a lot, and I know some of us on our speaking circuits have talked about the fact that we evaluated every use of the word of should every 247 times if should or must was used. And at one point, I did lose count during some of the drafting, but I think we were down to 138. But I can't say exactly where we are right now. I'll do a spell check when I get back to the office. But it's my impression that some of those shoulds were changed simply because we were using them in the common language as we all talk, and not necessarily in the way, as Mr. Gelzer explained, our rules define should to impose certain obligations on auditors that have documentation requirements. Can you give me an example of one or two of those where it was really just common, it was the language issue that needed to change?
Sure. I think, well, for example, in we had a section, you know, we give a lot of latitude to the auditor as far as coming up with their combination. They can have a combination of nature, timing, and extent to get to the, they have to get to sufficient evidence, but they can determine and strategize on how they want to get to sufficient evidence by changing the nature, timing, and extent. And we've provided that for the auditor. That came out of the proposal. When we were doing our analysis of shoulds, we got into the discussion of nature, timing, and extent, and for example, we found that if the control operates more frequently, or as it operates more frequently, the auditor should test more occurrences. Well, that so now you've got this. I can put together a strategy for testing, except I have to remember that one should over here that I want to make sure I'm always testing. I'm always making sure that I'm increasing my frequency, and we weren't intending it for it to be other than to point out that, you know, if a control operates one time, then you're going to get a lot of evidence from testing it that one time. If it operates 1,000, one occurrence is not going to do the same thing for you as far as providing evidence. So it's kind of just what we thought was kind of a helpful thing to say in understanding the nature, timing, and extent. And so that was a great example of where we were able to take a should out. And yeah, we didn't really mean to say it that way. We were just kind of talking to the auditor.
I say this because I think it's important that when we talk about the reduction in the level of prescriptiveness, I don't want it to be interpreted by anybody to think that we've watered anything down. And I think that the focus on the objective and using these enforceable words such as should has been selective without demeaning or diminishing any part of the audit procedure. The last thing, it has to do with these indicators of material weakness, used to be called strong indicators of material weakness. And one of those that has been in AS2 and continues in AS5 is an ineffective audit committee. And in AS2, we provide, I think it's about a page and a half, a long description of potential factors and criteria and descriptions of elements of audit committees that may or may not be more or less effective. And it, people will note that AS5 does not include that 1.5-page description of potential factors. And I wonder if you could comment as to why.
Sure. I think you probably already hinted at it, given just the visual space that that direction took up and the level of detail that it went into. We initially, the staff identified it as something that could be omitted from AS5 simply because it started to really stick out as being out of character with our new drafting style that is much more concise. It certainly wasn't identified to signal in any way any kind of decreased importance here. Quite the contrary, there is, as you know and follow closely, a growing body of literature that would help an auditor determine what are best practices, how to evaluate the effectiveness of an audit committee, and if anything, you know, not only do we hope the revisions to the indicators will otherwise improve auditors' evaluations, that absent that level of detail, that that might encourage auditors to keep better pace with what is better known as best practices currently for audit committees and bring that to bear in their evaluation of the audit committee in the future.
Thank you. I support that approach and, again, support the proposal and thank all those who have worked on it.
Bill Gradison.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First and foremost, I want to join my colleagues in thanking our staff for a very well done job. Well done. Mr. Chairman, there are many issues which have led to the rewriting of auditing standard number 2, and none has received more attention than the impact of internal control audits on smaller public companies. Discussion of the application of the internal control requirements of sections 103 and 404 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to smaller companies raises, in my opinion, two fundamental policy questions. First, what are the responsibilities of being a public company? And by inference, what are the implications for auditors of public companies? And second, do investors deserve any less assurance over the accuracy and reliability of audited financial reports because a public company is small? Congress has addressed these questions before and has been consistent in its policy. Neither the Act, Sarbanes-Oxley, nor the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of 1977 makes any distinction for company size. Not surprisingly, the statutory mission of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which was created by Title I of the Act, is to protect investors, and no distinction was made with regard to company size. It is, I think, significant that throughout the long and open process of crafting this auditing standard to replace AS2, there has been little or no sentiment from the investor community for carving out exceptions or safe harbors for small companies simply because they happen to be small. This is not to say there is no support in the investor community for a scalable internal control auditing standard that takes into account the complexity as well as the size of public companies. To the contrary, there is broad support among investors for a scalable standard, something the board has labored long and hard, and I think successfully, to craft. Scalability need not, and in the case of auditing standard number 5, does not mean 404 light. While public attention to corporate fraud focuses on large companies, the Enrons and WorldComs and others, the research is clear that the likelihood of corporate fraud is inversely related to company size. This, I believe, is a powerful argument for applying internal control requirements to smaller public companies. Much of the objection to applying sections 103 and 404 to small companies is, understandably, based on the costs of compliance. What is often lost in the discussion of costs is that it is investors who bear the cost of their own protection. When a public company pays the accounting support fee, which finances the PCAOB, the money actually comes out of the investors' pockets. When a public company pays its auditors or hires internal control consultants or adds to its financial management staff, the money actually comes out of the investors' pockets. In other words, those Sarbanes-Oxley seeks to protect, namely investors, are the ones who pay for this protection And as near as I can tell, investors are quite willing to do so. Charlie Niemeyer has given a number of examples of that already this morning. As evidence of this willingness, I would note that when investors speak through their actions in the marketplace, they tend to place higher values on the shares of companies with no known material weaknesses in internal controls than they do on the shares of companies reported to have such weaknesses. External independent audits of the effectiveness of a public company's internal controls are only a part, albeit an important part, of the regulatory framework, which leads to investors' willingness to place a premium on holding securities subject to these regulations. Those who would throw in the towel at this early stage, when most public companies have yet to come under the internal control requirements of the Act, and in the face of mounting evidence of the value and benefits of having adequate internal controls, are, to my way of thinking, losing their focus on the goal of protecting investors as the law demands. Sarbanes-Oxley mandates several important changes in corporate governance in order to protect investors. For example, it adds new responsibilities and obligations on management through sections 404 and 302. It also makes fundamental changes that empower audit committees by requiring that audit committees, not management, hire and oversee the external independent auditor. This means necessarily and by design that audit committees are intended to function as traffic cops, deciders, if you will, when it comes to disagreements between management and the auditor over GAAP or over internal controls. A good example of this governance model has to do with significant deficiencies. These are defects in internal controls that are less severe than material weaknesses, yet are serious enough as to merit attention by those in charge of the company's financial reporting, which is, of course, first and foremost, the company's audit committee. Although auditors are, under AS5, only required to seek out material weaknesses, they're nevertheless required to communicate deficiencies of which they are aware, in certain instances to management, and in others to the audit committee. By focusing the auditor on the identification of material weaknesses rather than on significant deficiencies, AS5 has been carefully and deliberately crafted so as not to cause auditors to do more work than is necessary. Under the Commission's management guidance and the Board's AS5, both management and the auditor will be required to report to the Audit Committee any significant deficiencies as well as material weaknesses of which they are aware. Because both the SEC guidance and AS5 are principles-based, it is entirely possible that management and the auditors will at times disagree over what is or is not a significant deficiency or material weakness. I believe that having the communication of significant deficiency come from two separate sources will enhance the ability of the audit committee to carry out their clear statutory responsibilities to investors. Mr. Chairman, reaching today has been a long process spanning almost 2 years. I'm proud to have been a part of this effort, which is focused on carrying out the direction of Congress to protect investors. Let's face it, this is our last chance to get the internal control standard right. I believe we have. Now others will judge if we have succeeded.
Thank you very much to all of you. If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. Our second agenda item today is a recommendation that the board act to retain Rule 4003D, rather than allow it to expire on June 30th. We will now turn to our Deputy General Counsel, Michael Stevenson, to present this recommendation. Michael.
Thank you. I'm here with Chris Mandelaris, and
after the previous item, I thought it might be nice to come before you with a recommendation to keep an existing rule exactly as the rule in question is Rule 4003D. The board adopted that rule in December 2006, but provided that the rule would expire on June 30th of this year unless the board acted to keep it. I'll just briefly provide some background on why the board took that action and why we recommend that the board now act to keep the rule. The board's inspection rules, since their initial adoption in 2003, have included Rule 4003B. That rule requires the board to conduct at least one inspection of a firm in a three-year period following any year in which the firm satisfies certain criteria. The first 3 years of the inspection program, however, coincided with the board's initial growth period, and as a consequence, the resources available for and devoted to the inspections required by Rule 4003B increased from year to year. It became apparent that without some temporary flexibility in the three-year requirement, the board would to some extent be locked in permanently to repeating that year-to-year fluctuation. To avoid that result, the board adopted Rule 4003D last December. Rule 4003D provides the board with limited flexibility that's intended to allow the board to make scheduling adjustments that will ultimately result in an inspection program that from year to year is relatively consistent in terms of the number of inspections and in the mix of inspected firms, looking at their size and the nature of their practice. Rule 4003D accomplishes that result, provides that flexibility in two ways. First, with respect to any registered firm, or any firm that registered in 2003 or 2004, the rule allows the board to delay the firm's first inspection for 1 year beyond the three-year period provided in Rule 4003B. Second, in some circumstances, it similarly allows the board to delay a firm's second inspection. The flexibility is very limited. The board could use it to delay the first or second inspection of a particular firm, but the way the rule operates, the board couldn't use it to delay the first and second inspection of any particular firm. And the rule doesn't allow the board to delay any later inspection of any firm. But the flexibility should be sufficient, we think, to establish the desired year-to-year consistency. Because the purpose of the rule is this limited scheduling adjustment without any permanent change to the basic three-year principle, the board adopted the rule as a final rule in December without having first sought public comment. Nevertheless, the board invited public comment at that time, and to ensure that the board would revisit the rule after receiving any comments, the board provided that the rule would expire on June 30th of this year if the board didn't otherwise act. The board received two comment letters, and only two comment letters, both expressing support for the rule. Since the time that the board acted to adopt the rule in December, nothing has changed and no concerns have come to light. We recommend that the board act to retain Rule 4003D rather than allow it to expire, so that the board will have the limited flexibility that the rule provides. Just a couple of quick closing notes. If it hasn't been clear from what I've said, I want to point out that Rule 4003D does not change the annual inspection frequency of firms that issue audit reports for more than 100 issuers. Second, Rule 4003D has not yet been approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The board's submission for approval is pending, and if the board votes to approve this recommendation, we will supplement that pending submission to reflect that board action. Finally, I want to acknowledge and thank Renee Phelan and Suzanne Kinzer in the inspections group, who've been very helpful providing and analyzing data all along the way, both in connection with this rule and with the next item that we'll discuss. With that, happy to address any questions.
Thank you very much, Michael. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Charlie Niemeyer.
I move that the board retain Rule 4003D rather than allow it to expire on June 30, 2007, and the board submit to the Securities and Exchange Commission an amendment to the board's pending submission for approval of Rule 4003D to reflect a decision to retain the rule.
Is there a second?
Mr. Chairman, I second Mr. Niemeyer's motion.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer and Mr. Gelzer. A motion has been made and seconded, so the question before the board is whether to retain Rule 4003D rather than allow it to expire on June 30th, 2007. and submit to the SEC an amendment to the board's pending submission for approval of Rule 4003D to reflect the decision to retain the rule. As Michael has described, Rule 4003D provides flexibility to adjusting the scheduling of the first two inspections of smaller accounting firms, thereby allowing us to avoid significant year-to-year fluctuations in inspection resource requirements resulting from the dates when firms first registered with the PCAOB. In December, the board adopted this provision without first seeking public comment, in large part because we felt that the amendment was essentially a short-term administrative matter that was not likely to generate significant comment. Even so, we thought it prudent to offer an opportunity for public comment and added the tentative sunset provision so that we would be sure to revisit the rule amendment in light of any comments. We received two comment letters, as Michael indicated, both expressing support for the amendment. I continue to believe that the limited short-term flexibility provided by the rule is a sensible approach to prevent significant year-to-year fluctuations from becoming a permanent part of the board's inspection program. By providing flexibility to adjust the timing of the first two inspections of smaller firms, we will achieve a more efficient allocation of resources without undermining the important objectives of the inspections program. I favor retaining Rule 4003D and eliminating the June 30 sunset provision. I'll now turn to my fellow board members for any discussion. Mr. Grattison?
I have no comments.
Kayla Gillen?
Charlie Niemeyer?
No.
Dan Gelder?
Well. Just a short comment. I'd like to underscore, as Michael has, the purpose and effect of this recommendation. As I said in December when we adopted this rule on a temporary basis, I think the important thing about Rule 4003D is how little it does, not how much. Rule 4003D will permit the board to adjust the scheduling of the initial and second inspections of the hundreds of small firms that registered in the first 2 years of the board's operation. Without the flexibility to make those adjustments, the board would face for the rest of its existence, triennial peaks and valleys in its inspection workload as a result of the spike in the number of firms that registered in 2003 and 2004 and the initial ramp-up of the board's inspection program in the subsequent years. That's what the rule does. Here's what it does not do. Firms with over 100 SEC-registered audit clients are not affected by Rule 4003D at all. They'll still be inspected annually. And for firms that regularly issue audit reports on 100 or fewer public companies, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act requires an inspection at least once every 3 years. Rule 4003D will not make any permanent adjustment to that statutory three-year cycle. The goal of this rule is simply to even out inspection levels so that roughly equal numbers and types of firms need to be inspected each year. The very small number of comments we received on the question of whether to make the rule permanent, and the fact that those few people who bothered to comment were uniformly supportive, confirms that the rule is a sensible approach to what is, in effect, a timing issue resulting from the board's startup. With that, I wanted to ask you just about two things. I mean, first, can you give some order of magnitude of what we're talking about here? How many registered firms will be affected by this rule?
How many firms will be affected? Any firm could be affected, and how many will be affected is sort of a planning and budgeting matter that will evolve over not a lot of years, but a few years.
Well, let me ask more precisely. How many firms registered in 2003 and 2004 and are required to be inspected under the existing rules but haven't had their first inspection yet?
Those numbers, it's approximately 121 U.S. firms and 310 non-U.S. firms. But let me put a little context to that. I don't want to leave the impression that those are firms that even under the existing rule were required to be inspected by now. They're not. The way the rule works, you don't become subject to an inspection by virtue of when you register, but by virtue of when you first do something specific while registered, such as issue an audit report. So those numbers The board has inspected all of the firms that, essentially all the firms that were required to be inspected under the term, the criteria of the Act to date.
Okay, well, same question then as the second inspection. How many firms registered in those first 2 years are required to be inspected, had a first inspection, but haven't had a second? Because this rule affects the timing of both the first and second inspection.
Or the first or second inspection.
First or second.
There are, I think, 461 U.S. firms that have had a first inspection and have subsequently done something that requires that they have a second inspection, and that have not yet had a second inspection, although I think 72 of those are scheduled to occur this year, and then there are 29 non-U.S. firms in that category.
I think those numbers are helpful just to put what we're doing here in context. But finally, it seems like the procedural posture of this rule is a little odd. I mean, we adopted it in December. It went to the SEC. The SEC has never approved the rule, so in that sense, it hasn't taken effect. In fact, I don't think they've ever even published it. You can correct me on that if I'm wrong.
Oh, that's correct.
Now we're changing it. I mean, I guess question one would
be the same.
Well, now, question one would be, are there any firms that issued audit reports that should have been inspected in 2006 and weren't in reliance on this rule that's never taken effect?
No.
And what do we expect the SEC to do now? Are they supposed to publish the first one, or?
Well, if the board approves this recommendation, we will file with them a supplement to the pending submission, reflecting the board action today, reflecting the receipt of the two comment letters, and I can't speak for them, but what I would expect is that they would treat it as a supplemental filing to the pending submission and proceed accordingly.
Thank you very much.
There's no further discussion. I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. Our final agenda item today is a recommendation that the board propose amendments to Rule 4003 so that the board would no longer require itself to inspect certain registered firms that do not regularly provide audit reports to issuers. We'll again turn to Michael Stevenson to present this recommendation. Michael.
Thank you. This recommendation, as the chairman said, also involves Rule 4003. Unlike the previous recommendation, our focus here is not on the timing of inspections, but rather on the universe of firms that the board will inspect with a fixed frequency. Under Rule 4003, a requirement that the board inspect a firm is triggered any time a firm issues an audit report or plays a substantial role in the preparation or furnishing of an audit report. These inspection triggering criteria are broader than those in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Sarbanes-Oxley only requires the board to inspect registered firms that regularly provide audit reports for issuers. Our recommendation today is that the board propose and seek comment on amendments to Rule 4003 so that the rule would not require the board to conduct inspections that the Act does not also require. Though I want to emphasize that the proposal would do nothing to diminish the board's discretion and authority to inspect any registered firm at any time. There are two respects in which the existing rule encompasses firms beyond those described in the Act. First, the existing rule, as I mentioned, requires that the board conduct an inspection of any firm, of a firm that plays a substantial role in the preparation or furnishing of an audit report. That long phrase is a defined term in the board's rules, and for anyone listening who would rely on it, I want to refer them to that rule, Rule 1001. I want to briefly summarize, though, what it means. Substantial role essentially encompasses either one of two things. That the firm performs services that the principal auditor uses or relies on and for which the engagement hours or fees constitute 20% or more of the total engagement hours or fees, or that the firm performs the majority of audit procedures with respect to a subsidiary or component of an issuer, the assets or revenues of which constitute 20% or more of the consolidated assets or revenues of the issuer. there are registered firms that, by that definition, perform a substantial role, play a substantial role in one or more audits, but do not separately have any issuer clients for which they serve as the principal auditor. We refer to those firms as substantial role only firms. The Act does not require that the board inspect substantial role only firms, but the existing rule does. Although our best information on this point is imprecise, we estimate that there are more than 190 registered firms currently that are in that category. The second way in which the existing rule goes beyond the Act is that the rule requires at least one inspection of a firm, even if the firm issues only a single audit report while registered, without regard to whether the firm regularly issues audit reports. The result of that requirement can sometimes be that the board devotes inspection resources to inspecting a firm on the basis of a single audit report issued 3 years before the inspection by a firm that may no longer be auditing issuers. There are today 1,775 registered firms, and there are 829 of those firms that have issued audit reports on issuers in one or both of the last two calendar years. These numbers are somewhat higher than I think was anticipated when the board adopted Rule 4003 in 2003, way back even before the statutory deadline for auditors first to register with the board. The fundamental point motivating this recommendation is that, in light of those numbers, the board can best fulfill the inspection aspect of its mission by not routinely diverting inspection resources to firms that do not actually serve as principal auditor for an issuer or to firms that have not done so more recently than 3 years ago. To bring the rule into line with that objective, the proposed amendments have three distinct components. First, the amendments would remove the requirement that the board inspect substantial role-only firms and leave to the board's discretion whether and when to inspect any such firm. Second, the amendments would add a provision that gives the board discretion to forego an otherwise required inspection if, after issuing the audit report that triggered the inspection requirement, but before the inspection occurs, the firm has two consecutive years without issuing an audit report. Finally, the amendments would specify that if a firm provides a consent for an issuer to use a previously issued audit report, that act of consent alone will not trigger an inspection requirement. With that, Chris and I would be happy to try to address any questions.
Thank you, Michael. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Gail Gillen.
I move that the board instruct the staff to release the proposed amendment to Rule 4003 as recommended for public comment for a period of 60 days.
Is there a second?
Second.
The motion has been made by Kayla Gillen and seconded by Bill Gradison. So the question before the board is whether to release for public comment the proposed amendments to Rule 4003. This proposal is the result of our focus on how best to utilize the board's inspection resources. The existing board rule includes a self-imposed mandate to conduct regular inspections of firms that the Act does not require us to inspect, including firms that play a substantial role in audits but do not have principal responsibility for an audit. The board adopted the rule just as our inspection program was getting started, and for some time we have been reconsidering the requirement in light of the experience of our first few years of conducting inspections. We look forward to hearing from commenters, but my view at this time is that the current rule does not allow for the best use of the board's inspection resources. I believe it is better to direct those resources towards firms that regularly act as the principal auditor for an issuer. As Michael described, there are presently more than 800 such firms around the globe. Focusing our inspection resources on those firms without regularly diverting resources to inspect firms that are not issuing audit reports is consistent with the risk-based focus the board generally brings to bear in considering how best to leverage our inspection resources. This amendment should not be misinterpreted as a lightening up on what is required of any firm that plays a substantial role in the audit of an issuer, including the requirements to comply with PCAOB standards and to cooperate in any board inspection or investigation. The board would retain the authority and discretion to inspect any registered firm at any time, and through our inspections of principal auditors or through other means, We may well identify reasons to inspect firms that have played a substantial role in one or more audits. I'd like to thank Michael Stevenson and Chris Mandelaris, the Deputy Director of the Division of Registration Inspections, for leading this effort on behalf of the Board. I support the recommendation to propose the amendments and to seek public comment. Now I turn to my fellow Board members for any discussion. Bill Radisson.
That's right for you, Chris. My understanding is that with the approval of this, our inspectors can still examine the quality of the audit work that has been done by a firm which is not the principal auditor in the process of examining the work papers and so forth of the principal auditor. In other words, the principal auditor, if the principal auditor relies on some other firm to provide services in a particular foreign country or is actually the auditor of a major subsidiary, we can still get to it through the inspection of the principal auditor without separately having to examine the work of the firms that would otherwise have been covered had we not approved this.
That's correct, Bill. We can look at the work of anyone that participated on that audit, even though they may not be the principal auditor.
Thank you.
Kelly Gillen?
This might be just a little finer point to that same issue. Substantial role auditors are still required to be registered with CPOB, is that correct?
That's correct. This doesn't change that at all.
So we continue to have jurisdiction, and it's just a question of whether these firms are part of our fixed inspection cycle, and we would still have authority to either investigate or have special inspections. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Charlene Newman?
Mr. Chairman, I have no comments or questions.
Dan Gelzer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief comment. Since the Board opened its doors in 2003, we've reviewed audit engagements of over 2,000 public companies, completed inspection fieldwork for roughly 600 accounting firms, and issued final inspection reports on about 450 firms. Along the way, I think we've learned some important lessons, including that our inspection work is extremely labor-intensive, and that recruiting the kind of experienced, sophisticated talent needed to make the program successful is very challenging. Clearly, the Board must prioritize how it deploys its limited inspection resources. There are currently 775 firms registered with the Board. Over 1,000 of these are subject to periodic inspection under our existing rules. Of those 1,000 or so firms, only 829, or about 47%, have actually issued an audit report in either of the last 2 years. Only 10 firms, or about one-half of 1% of all the registrants, issued audit reports on over 100 SEC reporting clients last year. And 4 firms audit nearly 99% of the revenues of all SEC reporting companies, according to a GAO study issued in 2003. In light of these registration demographics, this proposal will help us concentrate our inspections where they will do the most good for the investing public. Firms that sporadically issue an audit report or that report on only a portion of a public company's assets in support of the work of the company's certifying auditor have only a limited potential to affect the securities markets. This rule would give the Board discretion to redirect inspection effort from those firms to firms on whose work more of the public is dependent, if and when it seems appropriate to do so. For that reason, I support the proposal. I'd also like to thank Michael and Chris for their work on this rather arcane matter and similarly Rule 4003D that we discussed earlier. I mean, just a couple of questions. And Michael, you began the other item by saying that you were pleased to report to us that you were recommending no change in an existing rule. Now you're back to recommending a change in an existing rule. In fact, you're recommending, in essence, that the Board undo something it did in 2003. What's changed?
I think what's changed is a little bit what you described in your remarks. We've learned things about what is involved, what's required to do an inspection right, to do a lot of inspections right. And I think we've adopted the existing rule at a time when the board was still speculating about how many firms would register, what the universe of registered firms would look like, how it would divide up among firms that issue reports and firms that play a substantial role. And after three or four years, we know something more concrete about those numbers. And I think that our view anyway is that it's in light of those numbers, it's just a better use of the board's resources to fulfill the board's mission by focusing on the large number of firms that actually appear to regularly be issuing reports.
I just thought, on the other end, I asked you a little about order of magnitude. I mean, just to place it in context, I think you may have touched on this in your comments, but say how many registered firms are there that have not issued an audit report while registered but have substantially participated in an audit of an SEC registrant?
The number I have, and it's imprecise because we don't have a way to get really precise information on this number, but the number we have basically from information reported on registration applications is that there are about 193 such firms.
Just kind of touch on the same point that Bill Gradison and Kayla Gillen asked about. In looking at the small firm inspection reports, and it's just like one of the problems that we fairly frequently see is confusion about the principal auditor requirement. That is, you often in the shell merger situation, you'll have the auditor of the shell acting as the certifying officer, but the auditor of the subsidiary doing the great bulk of the work, or at least looking at the great bulk of the assets. Do we risk, by this proposal, giving up access or giving up a way of addressing that kind of problem?
No. I think you're on to a point that it's true that the auditor in the situation you describe, who is not the serving as a principal auditor, not signing the report, would be playing a substantial role, and under the existing rule, the board would be required to inspect that firm. So the rule change would mean that the board's not required to inspect that firm, although the board still could. And I think maybe Chris could address matters related to the practicality of that situation.
Sure. In the example that you gave, where we are inspecting the work of the auditor that signed the opinion on the merged entity, the operating company into the shell, but did little or no work, that is to say another auditor did the bulk of the work on the operating company, we would still have access to and would look at the work of the auditor of the operating company in that instance.
And again, this rule simply gives us discretion. It doesn't preclude us from inspecting or regularly inspecting if we choose to.
That's right.
Anybody.
That's right.
That's the substantial role of firms. Can you give some idea of the order of magnitude of firms we're talking about in the other two categories, and those that have issued an audit report but wouldn't be regular issuers as defined in this proposal, and those that have issued an audit report but are consent, essentially then reverted to being consent firms?
I can sort of. I mean, those are both the kinds of things that could change from year to year. But we have looked at it for this year, for 2007, what the number would be if we of firms that are otherwise required to be inspected this year because of a report that they issued in 2004, and they haven't been inspected in 05 or 06, but they also didn't issue reports in 05 or 06, and that number is 19. And on the other part of your question on the consents, I believe there are, we're aware of 12 registered firms that have, since registering, provided consents for clients to use previously issued audit reports, but that have not issued original audit reports since registering.
So on those two components of this proposal, we're really not talking about a large part of our universe. I mean, maybe it's worth adding, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe it's worth adding that even under the existing rules, if we don't change the rules at all, if a firm doesn't issue an audit report during a three-year period, then it's outside of our periodic inspection program, even if it's some earlier period they issued an audit report.
That's right. And part of what we're talking about is the 19 firms, for example, that issued reports in 04 and haven't since, You might, under the existing rule, inspect them this year, but if they continue not to issue reports, they would never come up for inspection again.
Just one last question. Does this proposal have any tie to our periodic and annual reporting rules that were proposed, I know, a year or so ago? In other words, will those rules give us better information about what firms would be regular subject to periodic audits because they're regular issuers, or do we get that information through some other method?
So we have plenty of information about whether firms are issuing audit reports, and the program relies on that information to identify those firms and schedule inspections.
And where does that information come from?
Maybe Chris can speak to that better than I can.
Certainly in the John Ameren's group and ORA looked to audit analytics for that. We also can search and do search public filings for that information. But again, that captures those that issue audit reports. It's imprecise and not necessarily complete in capturing this other information.
Well, but so then we can or can't make this rule work if it's adopted without the corollary support from the periodic and annual
reporting. I think Chris means it's imprecise with respect to substantial role information, which with this rule amendment we wouldn't need for purposes of scheduling inspections.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if I can say one thing, because I'm feeling guiltier for the thanks for the hard work on this without recognizing Renee Phelan and Suzanne Kinzer, because both in December and most recently they put in a lot of time to help gather the information that Michael's been quoting.
Our thanks to Renee and Suzanne. If there's no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it, and the motion is carried. If there's no further business, this concludes our agenda today, and the meeting is now adjourned. Thanks to everybody.